Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Polygreens podcast. This is actually our episode number 20, and Nick and I are here today. We've had a lot of really great guests over the past several weeks, and we've got a number of really high-level guests coming up in the future. So we're definitely going to be bringing to you some more exciting and interesting topics and people to talk to. But today, we really, it's just Nick and I, and we're talking about commercial production. So Nick, good morning. Thanks for being here, and looking forward to just having a conversation with you.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. How's it going?
It's going all right. So a lot of questions that have come in to Nick and I have been related to commercial production. So obviously in the industry, we're seeing a whole lot of hype about different systems, different levels of automation, and kind of that whole question about what's the right application, what's the right system, what's the right setup. It seems to be getting more and more confusing. We had hoped that by now, people would start to see which technologies were providing better results for commercial growers. But what we're seeing is a little more muddying of the waters, which is a good thing. We've got a lot of really interesting technologies and a lot of great techniques that have been coming out of that. But we really wanted to focus today on commercial production. So this is really geared for the people who are looking at starting a business. And this can be a small backyard farming type business all the way up to a large scale facility. So Nick, obviously, we met at a large-scale indoor facility a number of years ago. But why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the commercial projects that you've been working on and some of the more interesting applications that you're seeing?
I'm seeing a bunch of different applications right now. I mean, I think right now is people trying to find a niche, right? Their niche in the market. I think that's the hardest part. And the big question I guess everyone asks is, what could I grow with my hydroponic system? And I mean, we know that answer, right, Joe? We can grow anything we want.
Yeah.
But does it make sense running a commercial facility? It's about money, right? It's about growing a product that you can have a margin on when you sell it.
Yeah. All about economics, and when you're setting up, whether it's a larger or small scale commercial facility, the keyword being commercial. You're looking to use controlled environment agriculture to make a living or to provide a living for other people. And so the economics are a big factor.
Yeah, exactly. Well, right now I'm really focused on the microgreen business in Chicago. I just feel, about microgreens, Joe, I've always been going down this road of, I felt microgreens were more than just a slapping on a burger, right? Just the lettuce on the burger is just the lettuce. But more than nutrients, I mean, imagine you being able to have that burger and you're like, now I got nutrients on it. You know, I got the iron that the doctor told me I should boost up more or whatever you're looking for. So certain things in these microgreens can help people. And I always believe that. So I'm focused on that. In Chicago, there's this program that I'm working with. Actually they're targeting people that were incarcerated. They come out and they go to like a halfway house and they go through a program. So they're teamed up with neighborhood programs, the farm is, and then they hire some of these people in, these ex-felons in, and then they train them in the hydroponic systems, growing microgreens vertically, which is awesome. I mean, the farm is running awesome. And so I've been focused on more of helping them with the distributing side and connecting with the distributors and getting that going for them so the program can continue to help the neighborhood.
That's very cool. Microgreens are interesting too because the actual production has been, being when I was in the mid 1980s, they were growers producing microgreens and it really was something that the markets needed to be developed. And that, of course, came through education. So, people's understanding of the nutritional value of microgreens. And as you said, microgreens really have been looked at for a long time. It's kind of a garnish. Yeah, they look kind of cool. They're pretty colorful and interesting looking. But
it was a garnish and an ingredient. That were the two things for sure. I came into it thinking it was just a garnish, Joe. And then there was a high-end chef, a French restaurant in Chicago, that told me it's also an ingredient.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then now we're taking it a step further. Now it's also a nutrient.
Yeah, the nutritional value of these is unquestionable. Also, microgreens add a really interesting texture. Texture is something that's a very interesting concept. A lot of people, we've done a lot and we've worked with researchers who have looked at flavorings. You know, it started with culinary herbs where people were looking at what makes a good herb. You know, is it the smell? Is it the flavor? Is it the combination of both? And what we found out, which was really interesting, is that texture quality is a very big part of the eating experience, regardless whether you're talking about tomatoes and cucumbers and peppers, or leafy greens or culinary herbs, or microgreens. And so the texture has a very big impact, and it's not quite fully understood, but the texture has a very significant impact on the eating experience, and it can actually influence the flavor, and it can, in some cases, actually influence how you perceive the aroma. So one of the big things that we've seen with leafy green production, when you start looking at, say, indoor vertical farming versus greenhouse farming or growing outside, is that the physical environment in all of those different scenarios has an impact on the cellular structure. So you can get lettuce, for example. A lot of people who specifically buy CEA-grown lettuce buy it because they say the texture is very, very fine and velvety, some of the words, crunchy. Certain varieties have a real distinct crunch. And all of that really comes from, part of it is, of course, you know, the variety of the cultivar, but a lot of that actually has to do with the physical and nutritional environment that the plants are grown in. So when you're looking at commercial production, we're not just looking at producing a head of bib lettuce, for example, or a tomato or microgreens, but we're actually looking at creating an eating experience and a nutritional value as well. And consumers, even in the past few years, have become much more sophisticated and much more discerning about what they're buying. So commercial growers really have some great opportunities with CEA in selecting all the different types of flavor and nutritional experiences that we can offer. So we're not just growing a simple crop, but we're actually using CEA to get a specific result. That's actually one of my big, when I instruct people and when I talk to people, you know, coming from a farming background, I'm always kind of looking a little bit more at that kind of pragmatic, practical application. You know, my father used to always ask me, well, what are you doing? What are you trying to accomplish? And it really forced me to think back, and I don't grow using hydroponic techniques because I just want to grow using hydroponic techniques, but rather I'm trying to grow very, very specific products. In my own experience in Massachusetts, I had a limited growing season. I wanted to grow high-end leafy greens. I wanted to grow them year-round. And I had to look at kind of what the markets were looking for, what the consumers valued and what they were looking for, and kind of build my growing around that. And I think most of the successful growers today do that. They're kind of fulfilling consumer demands, and they're using CEA techniques. You know, I know that when you and I met, you were growing very, very high-end plant material for very specific. I mean, you were always in there tasting things and smelling things and making sure that how you grew them, you know, observing the impacts. You know, that's something.
And that was all due to my Rolodex, right? Where my Rolodex was Michelin star restaurants. So when you're dealing with Michelin star restaurants, that's the first thing they did. I mean, they would take it and they would take a leaf and they would clap the leaf and then they would smell it in their nose for like 10 seconds. And I'm just like, what are these guys doing? He's like, not enough oils. You know, it's like he knew like how much oil was in there just by, you know, they've worked with these little leaves. They know, you know, they've seen these things.
Some of my most interesting basil customers did exactly that. I mean, they'd be rolling the plants up, stretching the leaves, rubbing them up against their face, doing all kinds of things. But that is, you know, how they evaluate it. So
they're really your percentage level in oil, right? Content.
Oh, exactly. And if there was something
not enough water content in this one.
not right. So again, we're really looking, we're in the service industry, basically. Yeah, we're producing a product, but we have to produce a product I really encourage everybody out there who's looking at growing commercial, or maybe who even is growing commercially, is that you're not just growing lettuce to sell or growing tomatoes to sell, but you're looking to satisfy a very specific market demand or market desire. And you really would do very well to examine that, to evaluate that, talking to people. So rather than just saying, well, I want to produce 2,000 heads of lettuce a week, you want to really fulfill something that maybe that's not in the market. And CEA obviously is the one of the best ways to do that, because you can impact so many different things early on in the greenhouse, you know, understanding how running, you know, warmer nighttime temperatures impacted the overall heading and textural quality of the lettuce, for example. You and I have talked about this, and I know Glenn Bierman was talking about it on one of the previous podcasts, is that with fruiting crops, tomatoes and cucumbers, if you have a very specific gourmet quality market, if you carefully moisture stress the plants, for example, you actually get higher sugar content and a better flavor. So plants have very specific requirements, and obviously as a grower, you've got to meet those. But there are certain things that you can do that elicit different responses. And from a commercial grower's perspective, it would serve you well, because it would give you a specific advantage. So understanding that, you know, is important. We have a lot of questions. I get questions on a daily basis. How can I make my tomatoes taste better? And obviously, there are a number of techniques, both from nutritional and water management to your environmental manipulation to choosing different varieties, even your timing of your harvests. Tomato producers can, especially if you're a smaller scale grower and you have that ability where you're not shipping great distances, but you can actually go back and you can look at how you time your harvests, timing to the degree of ripeness. So commercial producers tend to harvest tomatoes, for example, that are a little less ripe, and they still will ripen up in storage and shipment, but they don't ripen as completely.
You want to ripen them when they're a little bit pinkish, right? When the pink is starting to come in, right?
Yeah, depending on how long they're going to stay in storage. But if you have the ability, that's one of the reasons that you know, people to this day still will insist that no tomato tastes as good as the one you picked in your garden. And a big part of that, I mean, there's a number of factors, but the big reason behind that is because when you go out to your garden, you generally don't pick that tomato until it is red, dead ripe.
And then you got to use it right that day, though.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Your flavor profile is maximized. And so as a CEA grower, if you're selling at a farmer's market, or if you're shipping short distances, or even have people like with a CSA program where you have people coming to your farm, you're able to harvest a much more mature fruit. And again, that will go a long way into the flavor profile. So utilizing kind of your knowledge of what the markets are looking for, and it could be as something as simple as they want a better flavor tomato, they want a bigger head of lettuce or a more crunchy head of lettuce, but then kind of going deeper than that. And really looking at, culinary herbs is something that I have always grown commercially and really focused on, you know, what I'm providing for nutrition as well as the environment to impact that and come up with a higher quality to meet those market demands. One of the things that people tend to forget, a lot of times when, you know, we're at industry events or companies are trying to promote their product, is one of the things that they tend to promote is this notion that if you're growing using a hydroponic system and you're growing your lettuce or your tomatoes, if you have local product, there's always an overwhelming demand and the world is going to beat a path to your door. And that's really been one of the biggest challenges that I've seen advising growers, and even as a grower myself, is that's not true. You could grow the best tomatoes in the world and you could end up not selling any of them.
So because the market might be saturated.
Sales and marketing is just a very big part of your business and it has to be looked at as such. But also too, in the fresh produce industry, and I've spent my entire life in the fresh produce industry. And one of the things that I've seen consistently is that in almost all areas of the world, the fresh produce industry is very competitive. And so as a grower, you need to grow products, one, crops that are market competitive. That's one of the big challenges in the indoor vertical industry, particularly, is in general, they're growing crops that are not necessarily market competitive with what else is available. And this kind of notion of, well, I grew it and someone should buy it, really just doesn't, you know, carry water. You have to be growing products that are very competitive, if not superior, to everything in the marketplace. And fortunately, as a CEA grower, you have the ability to grow very, very high quality product. But if you're new to the industry, or if you're looking at becoming a grower, having a really good understanding of what is currently available in the marketplace is really important. For example, we have a number of lettuce growers. Obviously, leafy greens is one of the fastest growing segments of the CEA industry. And in most areas of the country, there's a good demand for pesticide-free, high-quality greens. But you do have to look at what's available, because there are farming companies that are fulfilling those niches. And as you said, if the market is saturated, particularly at certain times of the year, having that product doesn't necessarily mean you're going to sell it. So
no, it's two different jobs. There should be somebody doing the market research on what yous are going to sell, what product yous want to sell, see if the market's there, see how big the market is. First off, if the market's small and it's saturated, then you're probably not going to get any sales in that market. You want a market where it's huge and they can't keep up with that demand. That's the market you want.
Yeah, and that's one of the beauties of CEA, is that you can pivot quickly. So let's say, for example, you're a leafy greens grower and you've got an NFT system and you're growing bib lettuce. And I've seen this. I've had this actually happen to me, is that you may have a larger grower move in, or a grower that's in there competing, and you can continue to compete and go head to head, and there may be compelling reasons to do that, but it's also valuable and very important to look at other crops that you can grow. And we've had
crops that can be consistent, right? Because we go to that, right? That's the number, two, maybe second important part on that.
For sure.
Consistency. If you're not consistent, then ain't nobody want to work with you in industry and a commercial level.
Yeah, I'm going to pass on a couple dirty little secrets of the fresh produce industry that a lot of people don't know. When you talk with a buyer, I always encourage people, if you're going to, let's say you're going to a local Whole Foods and you want to get a better idea about what they're selling or what you could grow for them, obviously making an appointment with the corporate buyer is certainly valuable. But it's also a mistake in many cases, because they won't give you really specific information. Produce buyers in general are, by their training, they are specifically competing or encouraging competition between growers, and they are looking for as many sources as possible. So they don't always necessarily tell you what the most valuable information for you would be. I always recommend going in and talking to the men and women that work on the sales floor, going in and talking to that person that's stocking the shelves and finding out what customers are buying, what crops do you normally have trouble getting? Are you getting lettuce that's...
Most of the time, the person stocking is the buyer.
Yeah, and they understand that. And consistency is one of the big key factors. And if you want to lose a produce contract or relationship, the quickest way to do that is be inconsistent, especially with your quality. Yeah, your product should look the same and be the same size.
You know what? One good way of just do exactly what you said. Show up, but then show up the next week at the same time, the same day. And do that 3 to 4 times in a row until you get that guy to say a yes, or to even to him to take a sample.
Yeah, building a market for your product is part of the process, and that's built on relationships. Yes, it's very important to have a high quality product, well packaged, to their standards. Yes, but it's the relationship that makes that sale possible, and then that relationship is never ending. And that's one of the things I think that people also tend to overlook, is that I worked very long time to get our sweet basil into the Whole Foods chain here in the Northeast and then the North Atlantic corridor. And what we found was, is that once the sale was made, in my mind, that's it. Okay, we're going to now sell 300 cases of basil a week. And what we found, unfortunately, was there were a lot of challenges, because there always are. There'll be questions about your product. There'll be issues with shipments. There'll be issues with deliveries, how the crops are packaged. And so you have to maintain a constant relationship with all of your buyers, with all of your merchandisers, the people that work the floor. As you said, having a marketing person on your staff, if you're of size to do that, is really important. And the marketing and sales doesn't ever end. And so the relationship is ongoing. So your quality is very important, but that consistency of your quality is equally important.
And as your company grows, your marketing department and sales department should grow as well.
Yeah. If you look at all the really successful CEA companies, let's just take in the tomato industry right now, Sunset Produce, Mastronardi Farms, one of the largest in the world, and for good reason. They very early on became high-level expert growers. They understood and they developed the farming system so they could produce high quality all the time, and they could do it at a reasonable price point. So they were very market competitive. And that's how they built their business. They were market competitive in terms of quality, as well as service, as well as pricing. And then from there, they expanded based on that, but they expanded into developing markets for additional products while still maintaining that consistency, while still maintaining that quality standard. So now we see not just the beefsteak tomatoes, but then they moved to tomatoes on the vine and cherry tomatoes, and now we've got all kinds of different snacking tomatoes and plum tomatoes and grape tomatoes and you name it. And it's all built on
my favorite, the gold.
Yeah, for sure. Sun golds are among the best, but that's a critical part and a never ending part of your operation. So as a CEA grower, producing that consistent product and servicing your customer, not only your end user, but whoever's handling your product, is really important. So these are all ongoing relationships, and when you are consistent in terms of your sales, your quality, that will serve you very well. That's something that I know you focused on for a very long time.
Yeah. And the presentation, right? The presentation goes a long way as well. You know, don't hand your price list on a napkin. You probably can get away doing that to an investor, but not a client.
Yeah. And food safety, of course, is one of the big kind of elephants in the room right now. Obviously, most growers have a very good food safety plan in place simply because they don't want to have a problem with their product. They're conscientious. Most growers are very, very focused on producing high quality, safe food. But the food safety then goes beyond when you're looking at, as a commercial producer, your retail sale. Obviously, your buyers are going to require certain levels of food safety certification. One of the more innovative tools that I have seen is for growers to now work their food safety into their marketing. So, for example, this grower has barcoded crops within the system, so they can basically track the crop from the day it was seeded, who seeded it, when it was transplanted by.
They can even track the temperature that it was in the whole time before it got sold.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and the cold chain is very important. So basically, their food safety software tracks the crop from seed, not only to harvest, but beyond harvest. So what the temperatures, as you said, what the temperatures were in storage, how long they were on the truck.
Even the transportation have little gauges inside their, they have little wireless temperature yes. and humidity gauges to keep track of that when they're in transportation.
Yeah. No, it's very, very closely monitored. And as a grower, you're spending a lot of money to be able to do that, to be able to track it. So you have a very clear understanding. And what this grower then did was they actually put a barcode or a QR code, on their products in the stores. So now when a customer is looking at head of lettuce, they can actually scan the QR code and up pops not only that information, but a little picture of who had transplanted it and a little information about them and a little information about the growing. Now, obviously, a lot of consumers aren't necessarily interested in every product they buy doing something like that, but people are interested in their food. And it's a great tool to then enhance the value of their product to the consumer. So they took the technology tool that they were using for their food safety, and they added to that, they turned it into a marketing tool. And it actually turned out to be very, very successful. And I see a lot of other growers doing
that. Have you seen these new like leaf spectrometers that are out that you just... You stick the leaf in there and it'll give you a readout of the nutrient structure in the leaf?
Scan everything. Yeah. People are becoming much more educated as to what's going into their food.
Yeah, scan right away if it's food poisoning right away. Like you can scan, check your lettuce when you get it at home with these gauges.
Yeah. But absolutely, if you were the attentive grower who has been listening to all of our podcasts, you would have food safe products. To begin
which,
with, but certainly,
well, yeah. No, but which is, and everybody listening right now also understands our number one rule is clean the systems regularly, clean your grow rooms regularly. If you're doing all of these things regularly, then you're on your way to have that high quality for sure.
Yeah. If I had to give one piece of advice to anyone looking to go into commercial growing, actually to follow my friend Nick Greens, who always likes to ask our guests, if you could go back in time and talk to your, 18-year-old self, what would you tell yourself? As a grower, what I would have advised myself very strongly to do would be to start smaller and try to implement a lot more of these protocols. So in other words, I would have, instead of trying to build the largest greenhouse I could and maybe cutting corners in certain areas, I would have built a smaller system, used a more effective system, maybe spent a little extra money on a higher producing system, one that allowed me to better monitor and control the environmental and nutritional parameters. I certainly would have gone through a much higher level of insect screening and insect exclusion. And proper environmental control equipment. In other words, rather than just having a couple of fans and a few heaters, but being having equipment to better adjust and monitor temperature, relative humidity.
And turning the heater on at 3 a.m.
Oh, absolutely. But certainly, at the time, no one really in the commercial industry really talked much about things like vapor pressure deficit. So obviously, we understand now more of that. But I would have really focused on that. And food safety and the process as it relates to, so food safety is really kind of a very big umbrella because you're looking at one, you're looking at your process. So when you develop your process for growing, food safety is a big part of that. So we want to be able to integrate that. We don't want to just have our process for growing, understanding our seeding and our transplanting and our harvest schedules and how we allocate our labor and then kind of separately looking at our food safety, how we're handling the product, who's handling it, what equipment you have in place to keep your food clean and safe, but rather all of these things integrate together. And that's
if it's a humongous commercial facility, then they should have a food safety officer in place.
Absolutely. Oh yeah. That's almost a mandatory, for larger.
Cause that's a facility. Whole job of itself. And and that person that's doing it should have a crew as well.
Yeah. And I know that's a lot of your consulting work, Nick. That's a lot of the consulting work I do. Yeah. It's actually helping a grower put together a plan that pulls together all of those pieces. So the food safety component or the multiple components to the food safety are woven into the production practices. They're woven into the harvest and crop management procedures. And then as well as we look at processing and packaging and storage and shipment, they're all blended together. So you really are developing a plan that allows you highest levels of production, highest levels of quality, greatest efficiencies. So this is in terms of your cost management, as well as your ability to handle large volume of product, your ability to produce very high quality, food safe products that not only meet the standards. So you'll have food safety standards imposed by your buyers, but you want to obviously meet and exceed that and then produce a better value for your customers. So obviously kind of understanding what consumers are looking for, what your buyers are looking for, and building your entire process around that. I know that's a lot to kind of take in, but really your physical technology, your systems, your greenhouses, your environmental management systems, all of those things, and then your methods all are woven together to kind of get that commercial end result.
There's never one way, you know, that all, like Joe was saying, that all changes just depending on your end goal. You know, what your end goal is going to change all of that. So if you have processes for tomatoes, doesn't mean you can grow lettuce with those processes.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the specifically the controlled environment systems are all, there's some consistency there in terms of how you manage nutrients and how you manage your environment, but they're all very, very individual components to that. And so when you're growing one thing, obviously new technologies may come that impact that, but then you also may be shifting what you're growing or how you're packaging it or what size you're harvesting your crops at. All of those things really kind of roll into your procedures. So obviously constantly evolving, constantly educating, constantly researching and experimenting. That's something we haven't talked about a lot yet, but research.
Well, they should always have an R&D lab, right? So there's always researching.
Always, even if you're a small backyard grower, you know, with a small NFT channel, having one or two channels where you're trialing new varieties. A lot of the seed companies, Paramount Seeds, Johnny's Seeds, you know, they're all, yeah, exactly. They're coming out with new varieties, new offerings. Consumers are, that's one of the things that people forget is that people, the consumer, they're always looking for new things. I can't tell you how many times we've been trialing a new product just for that. Oh, a new green frilled red oak leaf combination. A new mini romaine, variegated basil that we're trying for a number of reasons. And people are like, oh my gosh, that's really cool. If I see that on the store, I would buy that in a minute. And part of it is, yes, they like the quality of the product or they like some of the qualities of the product. But certainly consumers are always looking for something new. They want variety. They want that newest thing. It's why trends in the produce industry are constantly evolving. So R&D is a critical part of that. You may find new varieties of basil, for example. There are newer varieties that are resistant to downy mildew, and downy mildew is a big problem for greenhouse basil growers. And so,
and now there's even designer brand varieties, yeah, right? Your cucamelons and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, for sure. And so finding out what works for you, works in your system, works in your process, that's important. But then coming up with new products for market. One of the most interesting plants that I encountered was the ice plant. It's a small green, very popular in Asia. It's a very salty plant. So people add that, people on low sodium diets add that to their salads or to their sandwiches. And it adds a nice salty flavor without sodium chloride. So the process, actually a lot of the more popular crops that I grew, sweet basil, and probably most notably in the early 1980s, no one was producing greenhouse basil in my area. And I was a lettuce grower and we were growing some leafy greens and just tried some different culinary herbs and on a whim produced some sweet basil. It grew phenomenally well in our system. Within about 3 weeks, we were converting most of our production over to basil because the market demand was stunning. So you never know what's coming and you never know what will grow well for you or sell well in your markets. One of the big advantages of the CEA systems is, again, you have the ability to shift quickly. And part of that may be you just found a new market niche. It may be unfortunate circumstances. One of the things that we found with a lot of the food safety, the illnesses related to foodborne pathogens in romaine lettuce one of the things that we had expected was most growers were going to get a big bump in demand, and they did in romaine. So we had lettuce growers, romaine lettuce growers, excuse me, who were suddenly getting calls all over the place that they had a huge demand for their product, and they expanded their production of the romaine lettuce, and it was great. Now, a few years earlier, when there was a similar problem with spinach, what we found was that the market just went away for spinach. So CEA growers, in theory, should have had a boom in sales because they were growing safe spinach in their greenhouses. However, what happened was nobody wanted spinach. And even if it was greenhouse grown, people were afraid of it. So you don't always, and those were two very similar situations that caused very different market scenarios. Mm-hmm. And so you have to always be flexible and be willing to shift, because if you are that spinach grower and there's all these food-borne illnesses related to spinach and no one suddenly is buying spinach and you can't even sell your spinach, which is safe, but you still can't sell it, you have to be able to switch. You know, the fact that it's not fair doesn't really matter. The fact
of how's the cut flower business with greenhouses right now in the States? I know how it is doing overseas.
Yeah, unfortunately, the production in South America, the climate in a lot of areas, particularly Colombia, is so favorable for cut flower production, and they can do it so inexpensively, it's been very difficult. I mean, it destroyed the cut flower industry on the West Coast of the U.S. There are growers growing specialty flowers using hydroponic techniques, obviously, that for certain markets are doing very well, and obviously edible flowers is you know, one of those.
More of a niche markets than trying to go after a commercial market. So a
business, yeah, I mean,
if somebody came up with a whole business plan of like, yo, I want to grow roses in you know, Kentucky, good luck on that.
Yeah, I didn't see App Harvest building out 60 acres of rose production. So the market demand and competition is going to be a big factor in what you grow and how you pivot. So please don't discount the impact that competition has. I know a lot of companies that sell equipment, you know, will tell you, oh, you won't have competition. You know, you can own the market. Don't worry about that. That's something that we want to talk about. And that's something that from a commercial standpoint is really important. This is a competitive market. So you have to be able to grow competitive quality. You have to do it at a competitive price point, but you also have to be ready for the, you know, possibility and the potential eventuality that someone else is going to be competing with you, and they can beat you on quality, they can beat you on volume. And sometimes it's just because another grower has a better relationship with a buyer. We've actually lost accounts because a new buyer would come on and the buyer had previous relationships with other growers. And so you lose market share, and you have to be ready for that to happen, because it does happen in the industry. So being able to pivot and switch to a different crop or a different size or configuration is something that's always should be part of your operation. So don't ever fall into the trap that once you're growing this one product for this one market, that it's going to stay that way. And it doesn't.
And another market that they can go after is, okay, distributors, the wholesale market, right? Sometimes there's a company that sells to the distributors. So there's a distributor that sells to distributors. Mm-hmm. I never knew that this exists, but there are companies like that around the States. So look after a company like that. Look after a company that's already dealing with a bunch of distributors so they can send it to a bunch of people, because then you get that many more salespeople out there trying to sell your product.
But you have to also be mindful of the margins. So
you're going to lose on the margins, but the volume might be there to meet you breaking even to start figuring out your margins down the line.
For sure. And based on your facility and based on your business model, that can be an option. We've always heard people argue and say, you know, does it make more sense to sell larger volume at a lower margin, or to specialize in a niche where you get much lower volume but much higher margin? And the fact is that there's room for both, and there's no one right answer. So understanding, you know,
and it depends on business model, right? Like I said, the microgreen company that I'm helping, They're not about like, hey, we want to make $1 million to the CEOs and stuff.
Yeah.
They're about like, how can we keep this program going to help the community to keep it going? So even if we break even or make a few $100 over every month, I think the program's still successful.
Yeah, for sure. So that obviously that's a lot of information that Nick and I are throwing at you today. You know, we really appreciate you being here. We really appreciate all of the input. We ask you to please continue to send in any of your questions, obviously on social media, and you can email us directly. The bottom line is that if you are in this industry, you are a farmer, you are farming, and all of the same challenges and opportunities that are there for you are still the same. And so when you approach it that way, when you approach a commercial operation or a potential commercial operation, is that you want to look at, you know, very specifically what products the market is looking for, what unmet needs may be in the marketplace, and how you can exploit that. So those are all really important things. And then developing a plan for how to grow, for, you know, contacting people like Nick and myself, for consulting, for grower training, for systems, for guidance. That's really important. And that's why we're here. One of the, you know, the things that I did, you know, I was already a farmer my whole life around farming and a farming community. And so I had a great background. But even then, you know, I kind of had this kind of go it alone attitude. And that hurt me in a lot of ways. It helped me in some ways, but it also hurt me. So we have a lot of information that's available. Obviously, being careful who you select, who you work with. If you're going to be looking at a consultant, obviously a consultant with experience and who has a track record of success, both consulting for clients, but also a track record of success as a grower is really important. And then going from there, building your business model around those market needs, around those production methods and technologies that will allow you to be competitive. And then again, being flexible and understanding.
And if you're a new farmer, I mean, if you're a new business and you're just starting to start a commercial business, make sure you have your grower first. Then hire a consultant to teach your grower. But but don't hire the consultant before the grower, then it's going to be hard for you to transfer that information to the grower. It's just best that the grower hangs out with the expert.
Yeah, we have some guests coming on in the next few episodes, some large-scale commercial growers who are very successful, as well as some members of academia who have actually trained commercial growers. And so we're going to get that perspective. But as Nick said, the growing aspect is by far the most important part of this. Obviously, the sales, the marketing, the business aspect is also important. But you're a grower. You're in horticulture, you're in farming, and understanding that and building your models around that is really what will serve you well. So we appreciate everyone's time. We thank you again, and we look forward to speaking to you another day. Thanks very much, and have a great day, everyone.
Thank you.